Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to today's Teneo Insights conference call. I'm Kevin Kajiwara, co-president of Teneo Political Risk Advisory, calling in from New York City today, and thank you for joining our weekly call on all issues related to coronavirus. You know, the past week, I think we have been confronted with two very starkly contrasting images. One were the photos over the Memorial Day weekend from, you know, the Lake of the Ozarks and other places showing behavior that I think can best be described as pre-pandemic in orientation, cheering those of us who really want to return to normal as fast as possible and horrifying those of us who think the situation is anything but normal. The second image was the one most dramatically illustrated by the front page of the New York Times on Sunday, which was the grim milestone that we've hit this week with 100,000 deaths related to the pandemic in the United States. A mere 87 days after the first death. So in today's call, we're going to focus on the United States political picture, fiscal policy, Washington and state relations, the political aspects of reopening and going back to school, and all in the context, of course, of an election, which is only 158 days out from today. So I'm joined to go through all of this today by my colleague Orson Porter. He heads up Teneo's Washington office and heads our our government affairs practice. Prior to joining Teneo, Orson was the U.S. Director of Government and Public Affairs for Nike. And before that, he served in the White House as a special assistant to President Bill Clinton. Orson and I are joined by a partner of ours at Teneo, Phil Cox. Phil was the Executive Director of the Republican Governors Association from 2011 to 2014. He is a founding partner of the bipartisan issue management and advocacy firm 50 State, and he's a founding partner of the federal strategic consulting and government affairs firm Guidepost Strategies. And Jerry is back to help us understand the latest developments on the outbreak itself. Dr. Jerry Hauer is the former commissioner of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Services for the state of New York and director of the Office of Counterterrorism. And he was also the acting assistant secretary of U.S. Department of Health and Human Services for Public Health Emergency Preparedness. As ever, you will have an opportunity to ask questions, which we'll endeavor to answer later on in the call. But you can send your question in at any time, and we'll get them by utilizing the moderator chat button on your screen. So, Jerry, let me start with you. 100,000. The United States has got 4% of the world's population and nearly 30% of global deaths. I think the number of people in the world who get up in the morning and say, gosh, I wish we'd handled the pandemic the way the Americans have is precisely zero. But bring us up to date from your perspective. You know, where is the U.S. In the outbreak? And what is your assessment of the reopening and restart process that's underway?
Well, Kevin, we have been, playing catch up with this since the early stages of the outbreak. We were late to the table in identification of what was going on. There was a sense of denial. There was a lot of miscommunication between what I call a disjointed federal response and a disconnect between the federal government and state and local government. We had the problems with testing. We continue to have problems with testing. We've had problems with just managing the outbreak at the national level and at the state and local level. There is good news. We are seeing a downward trend in about 17 states. 15 states are holding steady, which is good news. Unfortunately, we're seeing a significant upward trend in about 17 states. And in several of those, we've seen jumps of over 50% in the number of cases. with there is also good news about vaccines. And we can, I know you want to talk about that in a moment or two here.
Well, let's dive into this a little bit more. I mean, I think a lot of people make it out to be, but it seems to me that it's not really a choice between public health and the economy, right? We have to get the public health part right. Otherwise, the economy is going to be under really consistent threat. And the public health part is actually not that hard. I mean, we know how the virus is essentially transmitted. So we know that physical distance is key to mitigating the spread. But at the same time, therefore, that makes going back to work, going back to the workplace, let's put it that way, since we've all been working here, but it makes going back to the workplace incredibly challenging, and it makes wanting to patronize, you know, a store or a restaurant or a theater or a sporting venue a prospect that at least is going to make you think twice. But public health here also has to deal with or address all of the issues that could result from prolonged economic lockdown and distress, right? Depression, right. Anxiety, substance abuse, malnutrition, domestic violence, all of these things potentially on the uptick. So talk about this a little bit more, because I think that thoughtful government and business leaders are really scrambling and struggling to find this right balance.
Well, you know, Kevin, there's a third leg to the stool, and the third leg is politics. There's the economy, the stress between the economy and public health, and then there's the political driver, which is creating part of the problem. A lot of these governors want to politically be able to say they've opened up. The message coming from the White House and from a lot of these governors is we're good to open up. As a result, you have scenarios like we saw this weekend where you have hundreds of people congregating in various events. The Lake of the Ozarks was just mind-boggling to see that many people in an environment where spread can be rampant. That messaging is the political component, and that political component, which Orson and Phil will talk about, puts pressure on the public health component, and that then puts pressure on the economic component. We have got to get people understanding that if they don't behave properly, if they don't follow the appropriate public health guidelines, we are going to have an additional spike during the summer and a potential second wave this fall. If we have a potential second wave, or if we do have a second wave, the impact on the economy could be devastating. We will hopefully be at a point where we are starting to recover because the number of cases has dropped off. But if we have that second wave, it is going to be devastating. So we have got to balance the economic components and the stress between that and public health. And we're not doing a very good job right now.
Well, let me push back on that just a little bit, because, you know, obviously you point to some of these pictures that I mentioned at the outset as well of, you know, large congregations of people. And obviously the way that the virus incubates, you know, we would not likely see resulting cases for 2 to 3 weeks. But if you rewind the tape a little bit to some of the states that opened up early and many public health officials had warned against a premature opening. And I want to go to Georgia in particular, which I think was one of the first major states to really reopen, to the point that even once the governor did so, the president, who had encouraged him beforehand, kind of tried to put the brakes on after the governor did so. But nonetheless, now that's several weeks on, we haven't seen a severe spike in cases in Georgia. How do we account for that?
Kevin, Georgia is one of the outliers. We are seeing a jump in cases in Texas, opened early. Nebraska, the hospitals are really feeling the strain. Iowa, Arizona hospitals are really under pressure right now. So it's hard to explain what's going on in Georgia. But if you look at the other states that opened early, we are seeing that kind of spike.
I want to, before we go on to the vaccine and therapies front, I want to talk. You mentioned that we're still in an environment where testing remains inadequate, which is just amazing this far into this thing. But you know, as we look at employers, particularly large employers, starting to plan their return to work. And this morning we've had another round of news that both Citigroup and Goldman Sachs talking about getting their trading desks in both London and New York up and running here in the next couple weeks, at least to a limited degree. You know, this question of whether employers should test employees. We've seen that Amazon announced that they would spend upwards of $1 billion this year testing employees regularly and building their own testing labs. But are there actual standards that employers can meet here? And I also wonder, and this goes to you know, the complexities of reopening from a business perspective. You know, this level of trust between employer and employee, because clearly, as you have pointed out on this call many times, it takes time for the real symptoms of the disease to manifest themselves, but you're most symptomatic, you're most contagious prior to the real flu-like symptoms. So in theory, you would want to have your employees feel that they could take time off and isolate themselves from their fellow employees and from customers prior to showing symptoms, prior to testing positive. Without fear of losing their jobs. Talk about this testing to come back to work protocol.
Well, there are two types of tests. One is a test to see if you currently have the virus. That means, am I sick, basically? You may not be symptomatic, but you could have the virus and be shedding virus and spreading the virus to other people. The other type of test is antibody testing. And the antibody testing tells us that you did have the virus. Again, you might not have been symptomatic. You had the virus. You now have antibodies. The problem with both of these tests is the tests were rushed to the market. And with both of these tests, there were a lot of tests put out that simply didn't work. They were garbage, particularly the rapid tests that give you results in 10 to 15 minutes. We now have some more reliable tests, but CDC this week came out and talked about the antibody tests, saying they're not very reliable and that people should not use the antibody test as an indicator that you have protection and you can break the stay at home or the social distancing, and that it's not a good test to tell you can go back to work. They also warn about getting immunity certificates, because the notion of immunity is that I might have immunity, or I might be tested to show I have immunity. When I don't, it could be a false positive. You then don't know how long immunity is going to last. I might have the antibodies. They might be protective. We think they're protective, but we don't know how long they're going to last. So when you think about the two types of tests, when you think about doing the viral testing, in order to understand whether somebody's infected, you basically have to test them every day or two. And that becomes an incredible a task for employers. Some say you can test them once a week, twice a week. But the cost of doing that is incredibly expensive. Then do the employers want to do an antibody test and say, okay, you passed your antibody test, I'm going to let you back to work? Well, with the guidance we just got from CDC, one, we don't know if the test is accurate, and two, we don't know that you're really protected. So testing has a bunch of traps, and until we have a better understanding of what tests are actually testing for what we want to test for and don't give us false negatives or false positives, we have to be very careful about testing. So at this point in time, I don't think employers should rely on testing as a means to let people back to work. I think by the fall, late summer, fall, we'll have a better understanding of the quality of the testing, and it might be sooner than that. And we'll have a better understanding of whether or not some of these people that test positive have enduring antibodies.
So as I mentioned at the top, the good news is that there's been a lot of development and a lot of announcements on the vaccine and therapy front. Just today, on the therapy front, the talk that Gilead's remdesivir and Roche's Actemra, the anti-inflammatory therapy, being put at working in concert with each other. On the vaccine front, we talked last week about Moderna, also the AstraZeneca, Oxford vaccine. Merck made announcements this week, Johnson & Johnson, CanSino out of China, Glaxo announcing that they're ramping up adjuvant production, which is a force multiplier for vaccines, so you don't need as much vaccine to get as many dosages out of it. Update us, Jerry, from your perspective on the latest developments on the vaccine and therapy front.
Well, you hit on right now, there are 11 companies in clinical trials. They've actually put vaccine into humans. To develop a vaccine, you go through first animal. You make sure that it is safe and creates antibodies. You then go into small scale human trials. That could be 100, 200 people. You prove that, again, it's safe, doesn't cause an adverse reaction, it doesn't cause the disease, and it actually is safe and is not reactive. You then go into trials and you do 10 or 15,000 people and you prove the same thing. What we're looking at with these escalation in trials and manufacturing is the federal government has basically told a half a dozen top candidates, we think your vaccine has got really good potential. So what we're going to do is tell you to start manufacturing the vaccine. You make 300 million doses. Keep your clinical trials going in parallel, which is not the normal course for vaccine manufacturers. And you make those 300 million doses. At the end of your clinical trials, your trials either show that the vaccine is good, it's safe, it does what it's supposed to do, and we now have 300 million doses on the shelf, and we can start vaccinating people. Or if your vaccine turns out not to work, it's not safe, you have 300 million doses, we're going to pay you for those 300 million doses and all the money you put into clinical trials. So they're taking the risk away from the vaccine manufacturer. The normal process is not to start large-scale manufacturing until you finish all your clinical trials. So So as you mentioned, we now have five or six top candidates. They're all looking at clinical trials right now. And development of the vaccine in large scale should start sometime in the near future. And hopefully, Tony Fauci yesterday was fairly optimistic, which he was not very optimistic and has not been very optimistic over the last few months. He is now thinking there is a possibility we could have a usable vaccine sometime by the end of the year, which is a complete change in his thinking on this. Now, once we get a usable vaccine, it's going to take months to go out and start vaccinating people in order to get to a point where we have herd immunity. And that point is going to be between 60 and 70% of the country having immunity, so we don't see the spread of the virus like we're seeing right now. As far as therapeutics, yes.
Jerry, just to clarify one thing on that final point, though, you're talking about herd immunity and how many, what percentage of the American population has to be either recovered or have gotten the vaccine to achieve that immunity. But just to clarify here, I mean, considering the nature of the virus and its attendant illnesses and the impact that it's had on the global economy and on global commerce, global trade, global travel, is it fair to say, though, that we ultimately really need to get the vaccine into essentially every arm in the world? In other words, you know, not 360 million dosages, but 8 billion, or if it takes two stabs, 16 billion dosages.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to need as many vaccine doses as we can to protect as large a population around the world as possible. It's important for the economy, but it's also important to prevent human catastrophes. One of my biggest concerns right now is Africa. When you think of refugee camps, when you see some of these countries that have very weak public health infrastructure, the potential for having massive numbers of people become ill and die is something we have to prevent. So it's not just the economic impact, it's trying to prevent a human catastrophe in Africa and some other countries.
So I want to move on here to the political side. I'm conscious of the clock here, but we did get a specific question for you in from our audience that I want to just address now while we're at it. We keep hearing about, and you made reference to a second wave come fall, not just a second spike of the current wave, but a second wave in the fall. What's the evidence that predicts that such a thing is possible or likely?
We've seen that with other outbreaks. In fact, with the Spanish flu in 1918, we saw three waves, and the second wave was worse than the first. So part of what we have to do is we need to ensure that we do not fall off the edge and just completely relax everything. If we can maintain some kind of public health restriction and structure, we can do something to attenuate or reduce the potential for having one of those dramatically high second waves. So it's going to be in part our behavior that reduces that potential.
Okay, great. Thanks, Jerry. But stay with me because we're about to talk politics here. And you know what it's like when we get the political guys going, we need to interject sometimes with some scientific fact, right? So, all right, gentlemen, I think we're well aware of the economic toll the pandemic has taken, most glaringly in the unemployment data. We saw another 2.1 million initial jobless claims just a few minutes ago. But Phil, let's start with you. Update us on the state of the fiscal response. I mean, it seems to me that initial $2.2 trillion was impressive, not only in its ambitious scope size, but also for something that's all too rare in Washington. It had bipartisan support, not just from the two sides of the aisle, but between the Democratic leadership and Secretary Mnuchin. And the president signed the bill very quickly. We can argue about the efficiency and the equity of the deployment of it. But it seems to me that, you know, given the duration of the pandemic and demand destruction, we have simply just not spent enough. So what's the dynamic? What's the timing? What's the politics?
Well, I don't think we know yet. And first of all, the number is $2.9 trillion in stimulus since March 5th, not 2.2. And that includes, as you point out, you know, there was a trillion in PPP funding for distressed industries. So we need to, I think what we're hearing from Republicans and particularly conservative Republicans is you got to give that a little bit of time to breathe and see what the impact is. The fourth phase is being debated now. And you have House Democrats that have passed what they're calling the HEROES Act, which is an additional $3 trillion in stimulus. And McConnell has, you know, sort of dismissed this as, in his words, a left-wing wish list, and has said that any next phase needs to be under a trillion. So there's really, Kevin, two debates that we're watching right now. One is the traditional Republican versus Democrat, McConnell versus Democratic leadership. We're also keeping a close eye on the internal Senate debate among Republicans, specifically the reactions of conservatives like Rand Paul or Ted Cruz to this sort of next proposed round of stimulus. And the bottom line is there are a lot of conservatives who remember the reaction to the financial crisis of 08, and they're beginning to push back. They're saying they want to see the impact of that first, you know, $3 trillion before we throw in another $3 trillion in stimulus. So we're watching a few things, specifically the rhetoric around unemployment insurance. Republicans saying it has created, you know, a disincentive to work. This is really important as states begin to reopen in phases. As an alternative, you have Republicans talking about back to work bonuses or tax credits. You also mentioned earlier, you know, we're keeping an eye on the liability protections for businesses. I think Leader McConnell has a pretty clear picture of what industries will be included. And we've heard in the last few days, last week or so, a lot of moderate Democrats have also sort of joined this chorus. And we think, you know, the industries that are at the top of the list are meatpacking and ag and hospitals and medical providers and maybe educational institutions. So, you know, so I think we're seeing those big picture items. We're also seeing a strong push for additional state funding. You know, I think those on the right have labeled this a blue state bailout. I think that's inaccurate. We talk to governors every day. Red states are being just as impacted by cratering tax revenue as blue states. Overall, I think on this next round, you see the timing. We see the calendar basically being pushed to the right some. As I said, conservatives, you know, and McConnell is voicing this, are really in no rush right now. They want to see the impact of the first, you know, $3 trillion. There will be a phase four, but we don't think we'll see it in June. We're probably looking at more like, you know, mid to late July at this point. And you also, you know, it's important to remember you have these must-pass items, the NDAA, WERDA, appropriations bills, highway funding. So unlike a normal election year where nothing really gets done, you know, in September and October, we expect Congress to continue to work into the fall. So that's sort of, you know, the snapshot of where we stand right now on federal.
So I want to unpack that a little bit, but before I do, I want to move over to Orson for a second, because Phil just talked about the not just the Republican position, but there are factions within the Republican side as some of the more fiscal hawks start to reemerge after the first big wave of fiscal stimulus. talk about the Democratic caucus and also, you know, whether there are competing factions or philosophical factions within on how to approach the fiscal stimulus front.
Absolutely. And thanks for having me. And before I begin, I just want to say this is the second call I've been on with Jerry this week, and I'm always impressed by his depth of knowledge, and we're lucky to have him on the team. On the Democratic side, you hit it right at the beginning of the call. You know, we're 150 days out. Everything that happens in D.C. is always viewed through a political lens. Nancy Pelosi, I think, played the politics right on the first two phases. This most recent rollout of the HEROES Act, the Democrats moved quickly. They weren't necessarily interested in having preliminary discussions with Treasury or the White House, or for that matter, even Senator Schumer, and passed a $3 trillion package in that, so they could immediately go back to their states, which, you know, $1 trillion of those dollars were going, as they thought, to some of the state governments, to go back to their constituencies to say that they were on top of it. But more importantly, you know, every day voters are watching the cable news cycle. And I think wisely, Pelosi knows if she can get ahead of what the Republicans may be thinking and vote out a piece of legislation, and as Phil rightly pointed out, there might not be a quick action here. The Democrats, in their eyes, see as though that, you know, they can honestly say that they passed legislation. They're, you know, waiting for Mitch McConnell to actually move a piece of legislation. And you've seen this in the past of, you know, all bills die in the Senate. So I think, you know, there's definitely a political tone there. And there are pieces of the legislation that are ripe for compromise, as Phil pointed out, the unemployment piece and the liability piece. But, you know, it's really about the timing. As the news cycle moves, and as Jerry pointed out, if there's a second wave, and in states like Georgia or some of the other places where we haven't seen it, and we see a spike, you know, in the coming weeks, then I gotta think that the Democrats will use that to their advantage, and you'll see immediate action on moving the pieces of legislation. And if you don't see any second waves, and you don't see a lot of these states show increased reporting of positive cases, you continue to see states reopening successfully, then I think, you know, Republicans, as they have done, would be wise to see, you know, what monies have been spent, are being used effectively, and then kind of reassessing, you know, instead of spending $3 trillion, you know, maybe we just need to repackage what we've already done. So it's really the politics of wait and see right now. The Senate is on recess until next week. The Congress has not been physically here in D.C. D.C. is still on shutdown, I think, until tomorrow, where essentially the restaurants will be able to serve you curbside. But for the most part, there's a lot of legislative activity you see on the TV sets. But I think, you know, for the most part, the elected officials are at home speaking directly to their constituencies, trying to wait and see how this thing pans out.
So, Phil, going back to the fiscal hawks here, and beyond sort of wait and see, and I understand that, considering the vast amount that has been that is being spent right now to see what the stimulative impact is. But beyond that, what is their sort of strategy in a world where, you know, obviously people, businesses, states, localities are all facing, you know, or many, let's say, are facing liquidity and solvency problems. And we know that at the end of the day, only the U.S. government can borrow at the scale And at the cost to benefit all. And so, you know, in an environment where real rates are negative, and some, you know, many states have got balanced budget requirements and the like, what other option ultimately is there? And especially because there's a counter argument to what came out of 2008-2009, where there was no resulting inflationary spike. Or anything. In fact, you know, it wasn't stimulative enough or fast enough at the time, and the economy took longer to recover than it potentially could have.
Well, that's not what you're hearing from, you know, conservatives. I mean, what you're hearing is we can't just keep printing money and driving ourselves into debt. So, and that's, you know, been the traditional line, and you're going to hear that even more vocally. And I think, look. You know, as you pointed out, we tragically marked 100,000 deaths this week, but 60% of those are coming from just about a half dozen states. And they're mostly in New England right now. You know, so New York, Massachusetts, New Jersey, you know, you got Illinois, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. But, you know, half the states have had 500 or fewer deaths right now. And so there is this red state, blue state divide on the politics, but more importantly, I think there's like a rural and urban, suburban divide. And, you know, and that's playing out. That's what you're hearing in terms of the policy right now. There's a push from both, as Jerry pointed out, you know, more red state, rural state governors, and then red state, rural state senators, to accelerate reopening and focus on the economy because they just haven't seen the same impact. Now, hopefully that will continue to be true. We don't know. We may see spikes this summer and things will change. But that's really what we've been watching and how we're interpreting things is how the COVID politics is playing out and how it's impacting the policy. You know, I don't see the conservatives moving off that position, Kevin. They're gonna keep voicing that. And I think what you're gonna get is just you're gonna get an additional tranche of stimulus. The question is it gonna be the trillion that McConnell has said or less, or the $3 trillion that the House Democrats have passed? My guess is it'll be somewhere in between.
Yeah, and you brought up something really intriguing here, which is this, you know, this sort of the clear picture, if you want to call it that, on the sort of the urban front and a clear picture on the rural front. That again, yet again, as we've seen in so many other issues, the suburban areas become in play. And I want to unpack that a little bit when we talk about electoral politics here. But before we move into that. Just a quick question on you guys' thoughts with regards to liability, and you referenced that a couple times, Phil, and potential indemnification, and understand the impetus there. On the other hand, the other element of going of getting the economy back to work is getting people to go back to their places of employment, and getting potential consumers to go back into places and spending money, and it seems to me that while there's a technical and commercial element to talking about indemnification, there's another message that is delivered as well, which is an acknowledgement that people are going to get sick and die by going back to work, and therefore we've got to indemnify people. If there wasn't a risk, you wouldn't need to indemnify them. So how do we square the messaging to try to, you know, to again, you know, convince people that it is safe to return to work? I mean, that's the bottom line question.
I mean, look, I don't have a great answer to that. I would say, you know, I'm a parent. I've got a 6 and an 8-year-old. You know, when we think about going back to school in August and September, people are going to vote with their feet. You know, they're going to vote with their heads. They're not going to There's been this discussion about, you know, Trump talking about the folks, you know, going to the RNC, the convention in Charlotte. You know, I've been to every convention since 96. I'm not going to Charlotte. Like, why would I do that? I'm going to put myself at risk, right? So, you know, I just think there is an element to that. And it's going to be driven, as you said, at the top of the call by what's going on the health front. You know, we haven't talked much about the states, but, you know, the governors in March and April were really focused on getting PPE and making sure they had enough ventilators and making sure they had enough ICU beds. And now they're very much focused on testing and contact tracing. And if you can get the testing and the contact tracing right, or at least make significant progress over the next 90 days, then maybe we can see a real reopening. But I think until you do that, doesn't sound like we're going to have that.
Orson, do you think that, so to pick up on Phil's point here, I mean, in many instances on both the right and on the left, governors and then all, and then also local officials, local governments are held in, you know, there's much higher approval ratings than perhaps there is at the national level. And so in a number of cases, we have seen, you know, we've seen, you know, good policy, we have seen clear policy, we've seen clear guidelines marked out. But at the same time, we've also seen governors and other localities working in greater concert with each other, right? You know, if there was a lack of coordination from the top, they coordinated amongst themselves with regards to moving ventilators from one part of the country to another or one part of a state to another. And other PPE and the like. Do you think that that sort of that network and alliance is better positioned then for this potential second wave that we can go about if we have to do isolated closures or re-lockdowns or whatever that states and localities amongst themselves will be better coordinated to meet the challenge?
Absolutely. And, you know, as Phil pointed out, particularly on the East Coast, I think the governors in the New York area, New York, New Jersey, et cetera, have really done a great job of coordinating their message, but more importantly, sharing their resources and fully prepared with their state teams to tackle the second phase, and, you know, probably have a better model because this will happen again. You know, this won't be the last time we see this. And I think regardless of who's in the White House, I think you'll see governors continue to do this in the future, to view things as you see in Europe and other places as more of a kind of a regional approach, in that people travel much more. You know, people in New York, as you know, Kevin, you know, you could live, work in New York City and live in Connecticut or New Jersey, or for even that matter, for some of us in D.C. So it is a regional a lens. And one thing I wanted to point out in the liability piece is I think there's another connection to the states is you're seeing a lot of states consider legislation to address the issue locally, which I think will provide a little relief. And then on the federal side, you've seen through the DPAs with some of the essential workers, plants, you know, food processing or where you make masks, et cetera, providing coverage. So these plants who make essential products are covered to make certain that they're not sued by, you know, faulty liability claims or potentially having their employees completely shut out. You know, on the governor's piece is a tricky one, too. You know, a good example, I think, to showcase today is California. You know, probably 3 months ago, California was looking at about a $6 billion surplus. A couple weeks ago, they announced that they got about a $55 billion deficit that they need to plug by July 1st. I think that has a lot to do with the pace, the Gavin Newsom and some of these governors have to consider reopening. You know, there's a front page story in the LA Times today of that Gavin Newsom may be moving too quickly. He's already facing criticism. I think you may start to hear that in New York and other spots. But having said that, governors know the longer that their states remain closed, the harder it will be to fill those gaps. And then with the kind of locked and stalled politics of D.C. of waiting for whether or not Congress moves or Mitch McConnell decides red light, green light, stop, these states, you know, have to make some hard decisions. So I think, you know, governors may have been popular the first couple of months because their decisions were a little bit easier to make. But as you get into the discussion of reopening and you start talking about some of the things we talk about on essential or what is, you know, they're opening gymnasiums in California. A lot of people are uncomfortable with that. You know, if people get sick, then you will see those popularity poll numbers shift fairly quickly.
So Orson makes a good point, because all these governors are going to, many of them are going to have to go into special session probably in the fall to address just cratering tax revenue. And that's when the cuts are going to drop. And, you know, like Medicaid budgets, as an example, are going to get hammered. And, you know, it took states years, you know, 4, 5, 6 years to bounce back, state budgets to bounce back from 08. And those cuts are, because they're local, because they're at the state level, they're felt. And so I think Orson brings up a really good point there. And we're going to see that coming, you know, probably September, October, November timeframe, where you see a lot of these special sessions convened.
And Kevin, let me just jump in. I was looking at the overnight numbers. California is one of the states that is starting to see an uptick in the number of cases.
Got it. Well, given what Phil just said and the timing of it in particular, I want to use the remaining time to get to the fun part here, which is the election. And I want to start at the presidential level. But before we really get into it, I've got to ask, you know, we've got, you know, one side, the president's side, that's sort of essentially been in perma campaign. And then you've got the other side, which quite literally basically can't get out of the basement. What is this campaign going to actually look like? Or Orson, when do you think, especially because I think it's the Democratic side that's looking a little feckless here at the moment. When do they really enjoin this campaign?
You may not see real activity until the fall. You know, don't forget how Biden won. He surprised all, and it wasn't like he was actually campaigning in some of the states during the primaries that he won. So there's a different kind of campaign this cycle, and we should get used to it. You know, Biden came out of the basement, as you said, for the first time in 2 months on Memorial Day. You know, any other cycle that would be, if I told you that, you'd say I was crazy. And I might be crazy, but it's crazy to think that he came out after 2 months and then went back to the basement yesterday to host a variety of interviews. So, you know, what I think is you'll see a very shortened cycle. People will probably use the summer to regroup. The campaigns will use social media and events to drive messaging and to fundraise, and they will use the current polls to reshuffle staffs, etc. But as the conventions kick in, I think people will get focused, and then you'll finally see on the Democratic side, you know, Vice President Biden aggressively campaigning. You know, he's indicated on August 1st that he will have selected his running mate. And then I think, you know, the 1st of August is when this thing really kicks into gear.
And Phil, the president, his obviously his most high profile way of campaigning is via the mega events, which are, at least for the time being, are on hold. On the other hand, going back to the 2016 cycle, the Trump campaign showed itself to be incredibly dexterous and reactive to being able to see where people would be, where they needed to get the candidate, and to move quickly in a way that the Clinton campaign simply wasn't. How do you see them looking at the dynamic of the politics plus the healthcare realities in terms of how they're going to roll their candidate out?
Well, I think they're doing it, and I would say that, you know, you made the point that Trump has never stopped campaigning. Well, you know, no president ever does. I think what you're going to see in phases, first of all, you've got the Trump campaign spending money right now. So they are actively campaigning. They're in the middle of a $10 million TV buy across, I don't know, five or six states. So that's happening, and people in swing states are seeing it. Second, you're going to see the president and the vice president really start to travel more, and you've already seen it. The president went to Honeywell in Arizona. He went to the ventilator plant in Michigan with Ford recently. So Michigan, Arizona, he's going to look for excuses to go to North Carolina and Pennsylvania and Ohio and Wisconsin. You're going to see both the president and the vice president over the course of the next, you know, 6 weeks ratchet up that travel. And that's really for two reasons. One is the politics and trying to be in the states that are going to decide the election. But two is really to begin to more aggressively tell the story that the economy is opening back up again. You know, I think their calculus is if this race is more about the economy in September or October, they got a better chance to win. And, you know, right now, with the focus on, you know, the health side of the equation, you know, the head-to-head ballot doesn't look very good for Trump. So he, I think, politically is incentivized to make it more about the economy. And again, the race is not, you know, nobody cares about what the national numbers are. It's going to come down to Florida, North Carolina, Arizona, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, effectively. And the state-by-state story right now does not look great for Trump, but it's also all very much margin of error stuff, outside of maybe, Pennsylvania and Michigan, which look pretty good for Biden. So, we're also keeping a close eye on the Senate. There's going to be a lot of money spent on a very small number of Senate races. When I say a lot of money, you're talking about, half a billion to $1 billion potentially, in places like, Maine and Arizona and North Carolina and Georgia, where really the Senate's gonna be decided. So it's gonna be interesting. I continue to watch, Kevin, again, how the COVID, how the politics of COVID are playing out in the suburbs, in places like, suburban Charlotte and Raleigh and suburban Philly and suburban Phoenix. Those are the places where this election is going to be decided, both presidential and Senate.
So I'm going to save the big question for the very end here, but Phil, can you just expand a little bit on the Senate? How do you see that right now? I mean, it feels in so many ways that American politics at the national level are taking on a greater, more and more of the hallmarks of a parliamentary system. In the sense that the president is just is simply the leader of the his party, and as he goes, so it goes. But is that true? How do you see the Senate dynamic playing out? And then also, if you could take a minute to just talk about at the state house level in this election cycle as well.
Sure. So I mean, the president maintains historically high approval ratings among Republicans. And has the ability, has proven the ability to impact nomination fights on the Republican side time and time again. So that is without question a fact. The Senate right now is 53-47 Republican. Republicans will pick up Alabama, and it looks Colorado looks very, very difficult right now with Cory Gardner. And then it comes down to sort of Maine with Collins, Arizona with McSally, North Carolina with Tillis, and then you got two races in Georgia. It's not, to answer your question, Kevin, the presidential race is a factor, but every one of those races is different. And so Susan Collins has a brand that she's built unto herself that I think she can survive. Yeah. Trump, you know, losing by a lot. McSally, not so much. I think, you know, if Arizona, if Trump loses Arizona, I think McSally loses. North Carolina, Tillis's numbers have been pretty soft. I think if Trump loses North Carolina, Tillis will lose. Trump loses North Carolina, we got bigger problems. I mean, that's, you know, that's an indicator that we had a really, really bad year. And then you got the Georgia races. So, you know, I what I would say is there's not a lot of attention on the Senate, but, you know, from the standpoint of a Republican, and, you know, standpoint of a lot of the businesses that we represent, they are really focused on the Senate because it could be sort of the last line of defense. If Biden wins, you've got a Democratic House. You know, we, from my standpoint, my side of the aisle, we really need to see McConnell there to sort of stop a lot of the most progressive elements of the Democratic agenda. On the state side, there it's not as busy a year this year. There's a dozen races, and there, it's just the way the map is sort of coming out. They're not, there aren't that many that are competitive. I think the two that we'll see the most action are actually in Missouri and Montana. North Carolina will also be competitive because it's a presidential state, but places like New Hampshire with Sununu and Vermont, which should be competitive, they both have Republican governors, but the Republican governors have done a tremendous job responding to the crisis, and they've got literally 80% job approval ratings right now. So I don't see a whole lot of movement and action at the gubernatorial level. There will be 36 governor's races in 2022, and that's where you'll see sort of big swings.
Now, I want to warn our listeners, we're at the bottom of the hour, but I'm going to go just a couple minutes over because I've got two final questions for these guys. Orson, I just want to start with you on the vice presidential sweepstakes on the Democratic side. Obviously, given Biden's age, there's been a lot of talk that it can, you have to at least take into account that he could be a one-term president. And of course, there's the Clyburn endorsement in South Carolina that turned his race around for him. What do you, how are you looking at the vice presidential sweepstakes?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, they always say it's a big deal. And then the candidate selects the VP candidate and it's no longer a big deal and the news cycle moves on. In this particular case, because of all of the things you mentioned, I think his selection will have a lot of meaning for a lot of folks, particularly people of color and some of the suburban targeted community that Phil highlighted. So, you know, a lot of folks have a lot of different opinions on who he might select. The list is, I think, pretty deep. So I'll name a couple of folks who I think are high on the list, starting with, as you mentioned, Congressman Clyburn really gave him the life vest to continue his candidacy, and I think will have a lot of influence on who that person might be. And the congressman has been very open about it being a person of color, and his candidate of choice of late is the mayor of Atlanta. And then, you know, the Congressional Black Caucus has also been very supportive through this process of his candidacy, and various members in the caucus are really pulling for Val Demings, the congresswoman from Florida, who was the Orlando police chief. On the flip side, you have Senator Harris, who would be very helpful on the fundraising side, would bring, you know, some needed energy. You can imagine Senator Harris and Michelle Obama, some of those swing states, you know, 2 or 3 days before the election, kind of having rock star status. And then, you know, there's a lot of gossip in D.C. right now about Elizabeth Warren. A lot of the Obama former team members have been fairly supportive. There was a couple articles today that quietly the former president has been lobbying for her consideration. And then because of what's happening in Michigan and it being a battleground state and the way she's handled the discussion there, I think the governor of Michigan deserves a really good look at. And then, of course, Stacey Abrams and others. So I think there will be a lot of politics in play here. A name that I didn't mention who is also being seriously considered, who is in a nearby media market of some of those swing states, is Senator Klobuchar. You'll see a lot of these VP candidates auditioning over the next 30 to 40 days on the TV, whether it's responding to the current crisis or talking about his candidacy itself. But remember, Congressman Clyburn saved him. Congressman Clyburn probably will have one of the biggest voices in this process. So if I had to tell you to watch anything, I would say watch what Clyburn says and how Biden responds, and that might tip you off on the final selection.
And I agree with that, Kevin, but I would just remind folks that the Democratic pathway to victory, Biden's pathway to victory, goes through Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. So that's the flip side of it. That's their calculus. It's like, do we need a Klobuchar or somebody like that who can help us win the Midwest? Or do we want to just, you know, rack up, you know, go with Clyburn and add a person of color to the ticket? So
here we are. We've come down to it. Guys, I'd like you to take off your partisan hats for a second and just be as objective as you possibly can for one moment. It's an unprecedented time, obviously, but the power of incumbency in this country is very strong. There was a rally around the flag effect, but it was short-lived for a crisis, certainly nothing like President Bush saw after 9/11. Phil pointed out that the president's got historically high approval ratings amongst Republicans, but at a overall level, he's never been above 50%. Nobody's ever been reelected with that. How do you guys handicap the race as of today?
I'd have to say, you know, it favors.
Go ahead.
You got it, sir. Go ahead.
As of today, I would say Biden has an advantage as of today. But again, I think if the race and the discussion is more about the economy, it becomes more about the economy in September and October, that is squarely in Trump's strike zone. And I think it's really at that point, it's a toss up and will be similar to what we saw in 16, which is which side the country is so polarized. So it has a lot less to do with persuading undecided voters because there's very few left and just motivating the current bases, the existing bases. And you know, Trump has proved, you know, very adept at staying very in tune with his base and then motivating them to come out.
Thanks, Phil. Orson?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to agree with Phil. you know, I do think it favors Biden, but, you know, I will say quickly that the polls don't matter a lot right now. People are focused on other things. I'm from Wisconsin. I went home, you know, a month before the last cycle where everyone in D.C. thought it would be a different outcome, and it was perfectly clear to me that Trump was going to win by the number of signs and the discussion I heard in local locations. And the Wisconsin thing that really thinks really – gives me pause on it might be a big year for Democrats is what happened in the Supreme Court race, and that you had, you know, nearly 1.5 million people ask for absentee ballots, and 90% of them were returned. and you only had 5 polling locations open in the city of Milwaukee, my hometown, where, you know, it makes up a huge percentage of the vote, and they were able to pull off a major upset. So, I think Democrats are pretty fired up regardless of the candidate. Trump won all of those battleground states the last cycle. I can't see how he will repeat that. So, it will be interesting, particularly if Biden stays in the basement. But, you know, if Democrats solely run on COVID, then they're in trouble. They got to find some other things to discuss, keep people motivated, find new ways of campaigning, look for Zoom moms to be a big deal. But as Phil rightly said, I do think it favors Biden at this point.
Well, guys, I've really taken advantage of your generosity of your time today. And you mentioned the mail-in ballots. I mean, we could do an entire call just on that. Normally a subject that would make your eyes glaze over, but all of a sudden becoming really important. So I want to thank Phil and Jerry and Orson for joining me on the call today. We'll be back again next week. Our subject is most likely going to be China, U.S.-China relations in particular, as you can see in that. Continuing to heat up throughout this process, but just in the last couple of days, of course, actions being taken on both sides, and what the ramifications are for the global economy and global strategic and allied relations. So please join us again next Thursday. Meanwhile, thank you very much. Have a great day and have a great weekend. Thank you.